This is an ABC podcast.
Tonight we head to the WA Goldfields for the biggest mining industry conference in the country, Diggers and Dealers. Shortly we'll find out what's on the agenda for the mining industry. And we head to the New South Wales mid-north coast where the seafood industry is hurting from Sydney's ongoing lockdown.
Everyone's got to get vaccinated, we've got to get the place open so people can buy oysters and buy any seafood, buy any produce. It's just not oyster farms that are suffering, like everybody's suffering at present.
And retracing the track of a World War II supply route, we join the Territory's Back to the Track convoy.
A fella said to me, this truck should be in a museum. And I said, a lot more people are going to see it with what we're doing with it than would ever see it in a museum.
I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide. Tonight we start in the WA Goldfields, where day two of the Diggers and Dealers Mining Conference has been held. Around 2,300 mining delegates have descended upon Kalgoorlie Boulder for the 30th anniversary of Diggers and Dealers, an annual gathering that is now the largest mining conference in Australia. This year, 55 companies will be presenting at Diggers, with familiar names like BHP and Fortescue Metals Group among them. Tara de Langraft has been at Diggers, and she is still there and joins Australia Wide. There's a bit of atmosphere in the background there, Tara. For those not familiar with Diggers and Dealers, can you give us a sense of the significance of this conference for the mining industry and Kalgoorlie?
Yeah, absolutely, Alex. So as you mentioned, it started 30 years ago, really, a meeting of around a dozen people at the Palace Hotel. Anyone who's been to Kalgoorlie or maybe heard of Kalgoorlie has probably heard of that place. Organised by the pub owner himself, Geoffrey Stokes, who went on to then own the Diggers and Dealers Mining Forum for many of those 30 years. It's a multi-million dollar operation these days with around 2,400 delegates heading around town, renting local houses. So, plenty of people making some pocket money this week, but also spending money in the local community as well, predominantly in the drinking establishments. But there are jobs for local people as well for the next week, setting up, packing down. And look, it generally makes the town feel quite alive. And that's because the conference, as you mentioned, it is the biggest in the nation, one of the biggest in the Southern Hemisphere, but it's importantly the only one that's actually held in a mining town. And it's basically where the diggers, the miners, appeal to the dealers, the stockbrokers, the analysts, the investors, and ask them to put money behind their projects.
Have people been able to come from interstate or overseas?
Look, with those restrictions, it has meant that there are some changes to the diggers' plans, some very last-minute changes. Even the programs are different to some of the presenters, so there have been a number of Zoom presentations. I think today there were four presentations virtually. Yesterday, the keynote, Professor Ian Golden presented from the UK on Zoom. There have been a few people I've spoke to who actually came to WA about a month ago on other business, and that was before the latest lockdowns on the East Coast. So when they happened, they actually decided to stay here. So not necessarily coming in for diggers, but they had been here and they decided to stay for diggers, and they're pretty excited to be heading back to their family at the weekend, I tell you that, Alex.
Yeah, I can imagine the logistics of running a big conference like this. Amazing. So what issues then have been raised in the conference over the last 2 days? So I know women in mining and certainly the rise of renewables are two of the main issues.
Yeah, they are. And I suppose diggers, to that sense, it's not really an issues-based conference. It's more investor presentations. But there's certainly been some underlying themes within those presentations, as you say, including renewables, electric vehicles, ESG, and that green image of miners really becoming a real desire for companies going forward, especially with many of them feeding the EV market themselves, and a big focus on a people shortage, not such a skill shortage, which we saw, I suppose, during the construction boom here in WA, but a people shortage. It's a shortage of people altogether to fill these jobs.
And today some big players in the industry have presented, Northern Star and BHP, among some of the others. What have they had to say?
Yeah, so BHP side of things was Eddie Hagel's pretty much his final hurrah before he hands over the reins. He spoke only briefly about their recent deal with Tesla, and he didn't do media afterwards. We were hoping to ask him a few questions, Alex, but didn't get around to it, unfortunately. On the side of Northern Star, this is their first diggers without Bill Beament at the helm. So Stuart Tonkin from Northern Star sort of mentioned briefly their recent sale at Kundana, but also I mentioned ESG, but they talk about EESG, so not just environmental social governance, but employee environmental social governance. So again, talking about that green image and also that focus on staff. So again, those underlying themes, but nothing really big breaking the news cycle. Of course, these companies all ASX listed, so they can't tell us any real secrets before they tell the market.
55 companies presenting, but only four of the presenters are women. Has that been raised by some of those you've been speaking to at the conference?
Yeah, it certainly has. There were meant to be five, I understand, but COVID restrictions meant there were actually only four here in attendance. There are two female session chairs, I think, from my count, Alex. And look, it's an issue that's mentioned year after year. This is my 15th year, so it is better than it has been, but it's not as good as it could be. And Elizabeth Gaines a couple of years ago mentioned that there were, I think, more presenters with the first name. I'm pretty sure it was David, she said, than there were women presenting that year. I'm happy to say that's not the case this year, but many agree it could be better.
Well, there is another day yet to go with Diggers and Dealers and more dealing to be done, no doubt. Tara de Landgraaft, Goldfields Esperance reporter there in Kalgoorlie-Boulder. Thanks so much for speaking to Australia Wide.
Thanks so much, Alex.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
And staying with resources, Aboriginal leaders yesterday told a Senate inquiry millions of dollars allocated to speed up gas development across the Northern Territory would be much better spent alleviating their third world living conditions. The federal government has started giving out $50 million to companies in the Beetaloo Basin because it wants that to be one of five new gas fields which will underpin Australia's post-COVID recovery. Traditional owners say instead they'd like more help to develop what they see as more sustainable and less polluting industries on their land. Jane Barden reports.
Aboriginal leaders from communities across the lands earmarked for gas fracking in the NT's Beetaloo Basin were called to give evidence by the Senate's Environment Committee. They all expressed outrage over the federal government's plan to grant $50 million to companies planning a giant shale gas industry on their land. The first grant of $21 million went to a junior explorer, Empire Energy, last month, which has gas leases near Borroloola. Asman Rory from Borroloola.
The federal and the Northern Territory government have the audacity to give away $50 million to the fracking companies when we have a crisis on the lives in this region that can benefit from this $50 million. Especially housing, families, health, education.
The Federal Resources Minister Keith Pitt says the grant is to fast-track fracking test wells in the hope developing the Beetaloo will create 6,000 jobs and $37 billion in economic activity. Such estimates were judged much lower by the Pepper fracking inquiry. Lightning Ridge traditional owner Johnny Wilson said he'd much rather develop his own business instead.
My grandfather left my country here for my family so that we may start off something of our own for our children, our business.
And he also feels the money should be redirected.
Making a better life for Aboriginal people. Come on, they say we live in a third poverty. We've got a government here that's supposed to help us, First Nation Aboriginal people. What is being done? Where are all the promises? Nothing. Now they want to take our country and drill on it.
Federal Labor's official policy also backs more gas development, with slightly less enthusiasm than the coalition. But the sceptical traditional owners had a sympathetic ear from WA Labor Committee member Senator Glenn Stirl.
I'm gobsmacked that we're giving $50 million to an energy company when I know the disparity, the closing the gap measures in the Kimberley alone is what we could do with $50 million up there, let alone in your part of the world.
Gas companies have official permission to test frack in the Beetaloo from traditional owners following consultation carried out by the Northern Land Council. Nicholas Fitzpatrick from Borroloola complained legally required informed consent wasn't gained.
There was no information explaining exactly the risks of this industry. All they were talking about is royalty, 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 almost like blackmailing people to sign something just to get this bit of money.
NT Country Liberal Senator Sam McMahon questioned allegations from many, including traditional owner Joni Wilson. Informed consent hasn't been gained.
Was it your evidence that everyone at that meeting said no to oil and gas exploration on their country?
Yeah, everyone said no. Every traditional owner from piece of that country. I'm also one of the traditional owners from that country.
As did the Land Council's CEO, Joe Martin George.
The Northern Land Council keeps the highest standards of advice and assistance to our constituents. We reject any suggestion to the contrary.
Senator McMahon also queried the claims the industry will cause pollution.
So do you have any actual evidence that poison is going to spread through the land or the water?
It's just common sense to know that this industry has a lot of risk factors.
Ms. Wilson, thank you. Look, with all due respect, we're not talking about common sense. We're actually talking about scientific evidence.
I could get proof and evidence. Yes, I can provide it if you're asking for that.
Yes, please.
Empire Energy declined an interview, but it told the inquiry last week it's made sure it's gained informed consent from traditional owners and it's committed to carrying out its operations safely with minimal environmental impact. The Indigenous leaders ended their evidence, appealing to the committee to recommend the government cease subsidising an industry they don't want on their land.
I just can't see the point having all these work opportunities if our country, our water, is damaged. Water is life. No water, there's no life. Please help us on our country.
That's Beetaloo Basin traditional owner Johnny Wilson ending Jane Barden's report. To the New South Wales mid-north coast, where a fresh seafood business owner says lockdowns are creating a fear of spending on delicacies such as oysters. With lockdown continuing in Greater Sydney, regional towns are dealing with a downturn in spending due to the lack of winter trade and a change in spending habits. Seafood processors are hoping markets like Melbourne stay open to keep up demand for their produce. Kate Aubrey has this report.
This time last year, Lindsay's oyster barn was booming, despite being in the midst of a pandemic. Owner Shannon Lindsay says there's more fear in the community this time round.
The first part of the COVID was pretty good because everyone wasn't so scared, so they were still going around and shopping. And then shopping locally was good, but now you had the little COVID casing coughs and everyone's just gone super scared. No one's going out. And then the cold weather now because it's winter, so no one really eats seafood in winter anyway.
Now would normally be a slow time of the year for you anyway, wouldn't it, during winter?
You normally get all your Sydney and Melbourne tourists this time of the year, so there's none of them here, obviously. So it's just super quiet and it's just relying on the few oldies that eat seafood all year.
On the Klang River in Yarunga, the oysters are plump and almost ready for harvest in 4 weeks. Farmer John Lindsay says he hopes Sydney restaurants will reopen on schedule to purchase stocks delayed from the March floods.
We've gone through a lot of disasters and there might be another one around the corner. But when it's good, it's good. But like anything in agriculture, when it's bad, you get a little bit down on yourself and the industry as well.
How has some of those big disasters impacted you? Obviously, more recently, we had the floods.
Yeah, we had the floods and we lost a lot of our infrastructure. Young oysters didn't survive the prolonged fresh water. Yeah, when we get a flood, we can't harvest the oyster till the cylinder level comes up to 20 parts. So we just leave them there. Then we test the water, and if the water in the oysters are in good condition, then we can start to harvest again.
So what's been that delay for you? When was your last harvest, I suppose?
This year hasn't been real good. We last harvested on the 14th of December. Then the year before, the bushfires caused a lot of problems with water quality and the ash appeared to have killed a lot of the oysters. So we've been kicked a little bit lately. And we're just hoping the season opens early and we can maybe start the harvest in another few weeks.
The Premier has announced that Sydney is in lockdown for an extra 4 weeks till the end of August, so that will look like restaurants stay closed. What do you think the impacts will be with the Sydney lockdown being extended?
The lockdown will affect all oyster farms, whatever river they're in. If the restaurants, the clubs, aren't buying oysters off the processors who we supply, it'll be a downturn for till it when opens up again, I presume.
What will that mean for you, that you'll have to keep the oysters in the river? Is that a possibility?
Yeah, we just keep them there and wait for all the stars to line up, and then we'll pull them out and depurate them and sell them into Sydney, hopefully. The biggest delay in not harvesting is you don't have any income. Everything else is all right. They can stay there for as long as you like. But we need them. We need to harvest them so we can sell them and make some money.
Mm. And I suspect overheads keep ticking over.
Yep. Like I said, haven't harvested since December last year, so it's things are getting a little bit tight, yes.
And have you been able to access any support? We've had JobKeeper last year and there's JobSaver that's coming up.
No, there's a grant out to fix up the infrastructure and the oysters that we've lost. I've applied for it, but as yet I haven't received back. We'll get through it, but it's just going to set us all back a little bit. Everyone's got to get vaccinated. We've got to get the place open so people can buy oysters and buy any seafood, buy any produce. It's just not oyster farms that are suffering. Like, everybody's suffering at present.
And so I guess, like the million-dollar question, what's the secret to shucking an oyster?
The most helpful advice I ever give, you don't have six beers before you try.
And how do you have an oyster? What's the best way? Is it got to be fresh?
Fresh, natural. Sitting with your feet in the salt water is the best it gets.
There you go. That was Urunga oyster farmer John Lindsay speaking to our reporter Kate Albury there at the edge of the Kallang River.
You're listening to Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
To Alice Springs now, where a convoy of vintage wartime vehicles are making their way along an old military supply route from the Second World War. The Back to the Track convoy, as it's known, first started in 1995, and it retraces the track that supply vehicles took in World War II to service Darwin. Some of the vehicles have a territory military connection, including some that were used in World War II during the bombing of Darwin. The convoy will arrive in Darwin 76 years to the day that Japan surrendered, marking the end of the Second World War. Participants have travelled from across the country, including Victoria and Western Australia. Alice Springs reporter Justin Fenwick spoke to some of them as they rolled into Alice Springs.
These vehicles will travel 1,500 kilometres, retracing the old supply track that service and military vehicles travelled to help supply Darwin during the Battle for Australia. Included in the convoy, a long-nosed Chevrolet truck that was once on a ship bound for Timor when it was sunk on February 19, 1942, in the bombing of Darwin. Richard Davies from Western Australia drove the truck, which was once at the bottom of Darwin Harbour, and says that it's vehicles like these that are important for educating the community in Australia's military past.
Well, I reckon it is a lot, and at a fuel station on the way, a fella said to me, this truck should be in a museum, and I said, a lot more people are going to see it with what we're doing with it than would ever see it in a museum. You know, we're driving it up the road, everyone sees it, everyone waves. It's a great thing to see it moving around, I reckon. I'm more for collections rather than museums.
Alan Carpenter travelled with his family from Victoria and have spent a month trying to avoid border closures.
Well, actually, I was very lucky because Kerry took a month off holidays, so I said, right, we're going to sacrifice a month even getting here. So if something goes wrong, let's face it, you're driving these old vehicles and anything can go wrong. But we had a dream run up, well, there's no doubt
we
about that.
We timed it beautifully. We left home on the 5th of July. The borders were lifting in front of us and they were closing behind us. So we just timed it magically.
So we were very lucky and to get here. And as I say, we had a dream run as far as breakdowns are concerned. So let's face it, they're 60, 70-year-old vehicles.
Try nearly 80.
Oh, well, there you go, too. Yeah. So we've been very lucky.
Mr. Carpenter and his daughter, Kerry, say that These events are important for those whose families were involved in previous military operations and acknowledges we shouldn't forget our military past.
We've lost so much of it, haven't we? Like, we learn all about other countries overseas, but we're forgetting about what actually happened here in the early days, right through from the Aboriginals right up to them, to the Aboriginals that played their part in the war too. That's forgotten, and it should never be forgotten. It actually happened, right? They played a part in it, so they should be here with us today, you know, because there's still families of them that still remember that. It's a part that's forgotten. It's a part that's forgotten in the younger generation. I'm just lucky enough that I've got a daughter that that sticks with me and with our vehicles and that sort of thing.
Military historian Dr. Tom Lewis says the reenactment of the convoy shows just how much the Territory was at the front and centre of World War II.
Alice Springs was a major, what you call, staging point, but also a major base. What actually happened in the beginning of the war in terms of the Pacific, in February, we got attacked very heavily by Japanese air raids, and they kept coming. 208 air missions across northern Australia by the enemy. And so the civilian apparatus fell back to Alice Springs. The administrator, for example, we have an administrator, not a governor, because we're a territory, not a state. He moved his bits and pieces down there, and he ran things from down there. And Darwin was turned into a largely military town where military law was what happened. And the Army News was the only newspaper. So Alice Springs, very, very important, but it was really a support for what was happening further north.
That's Dr. Tom Lewis finishing that report from Alice Springs reporter Justin Fenwick. And we heard there from some of those people taking part in the Back to the Track convoy up to Darwin. Some great history coming back to life there. Finally, tonight, if you're travelling around the country on holiday this year, you might meet some winged and furry friends next time you pull into your accommodation. The demand for pet-friendly accommodation has skyrocketed in Western Australia as people head out on the roads with their animals. Reporter Jackie Lynch has just made the 2,500-kilometre drive up WA's coast from Bunbury to Broome, and she saw many pets along the way.
Ian Marshall, his wife and their 10-year-old dog Coda have been travelling country WA for 2 months now. Coda quickly adjusted to life on the road.
It's great. Obviously we've got a big car and she sits in the back with my missus.
Mr Marshall's picking up work where he can and the dog's along for the ride.
We just took off just over 2 months ago. Leased our house out down in Perth for 12 months, so we're going to be on the road for at least 12 months.
He's not alone. Many people are choosing to travel with their pets.
There is a lot of people that are travelling with pets, you know, more than what would be anyway, just because of the situation we all find ourselves in.
Sam Hinton has taken his dog all around regional WA.
This is our lovely Pilbara special, Sirius. We've done many a trip, so when he was a little tiny pup, we took him down to Exmouth and Shark Bay and that kind of area, so he's loves the old road trips, probably about his sixth long trip.
For him, it's not just about companionship.
Pet sitters up in Port Hedland are few and far between, so it's just a bit easier if we just put him in the car with us mostly.
After a few successful trips with the dogs, Mr Hinton says there's even talk of bringing his two cats on a holiday sometime soon.
The wife wants to, but I don't think it's a good idea.
Travelling with cats is not unheard of. Cindy Barrett has run a motel and caravan park in Carnarvon for almost two decades and has seen it all.
We've had parrots, we've had guinea pigs, and we've had cats.
She's even had goats.
She had a sort of temporary fence that she could put up in the little corner of the park, and she actually, brought everything in with her, so that was okay.
18 years ago, her caravan park was the only place in town that took pets. Now, Mrs. Barrett says more and more places are jumping on board.
We started it off, but we used to have about half the park full with people with travelling with dogs, but then the other parks heard about it, so they started being pet-friendly too.
Simo works at a busy caravan park in the Pilbara at Point Sampson and says it's a common thing for people to travel with their pets.
Some people travel with birds, some people travel, well, obviously with their dogs are the most common. We get cats. We have a family that comes down from Hedland and they bring down their rabbit.
The tales of pets at the park are legendary.
We had Gandalf. We had a couple that were moving from Darwin to Perth, and during their stay, their cat escaped. So we endeavoured to help them catch Gandalf, it took us a few months, but we got him back to his owners. He's flown down to Perth and reunited.
There are ups and downs taking your pets on a holiday, but for people like Ian Marshall, he wouldn't have it any other way.
She's always been around us all the time, so it was a factor that we're going with the dog.
That story from Jackie Lynch there on the road. And that's Australia Wide for this Tuesday. I'm Alex Hyman. Have a great evening. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.